This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. A new House bill proposal is generating buzz on local college campuses. Legislation filed last week would allow concealed carry permit holders to carry their handguns onto University of North Carolina System College campuses and community colleges across the state.
I don't feel like that's a that's a good solution.
I think it would give people more opportunities to defend themselves if that's
for me. I don't approve of guns on campus.
It's a learning environment, and I don't really see the need for a gun.
Some say the measure will allow students and faculty to protect themselves in the event of a shooting, while others fear it will cause more violence and chaos.
I don't want to be in fear of my life from not just one person, but everybody at the school, because everybody want to have a gun.
Anaya Sparrow is a student at Craven Community College.
You could put a gun in the hands of the wrong person. They can get mad and do whatever they want to do.
Across the nation, mass shootings on college campuses appear to be increasing, according to a study by the Citizen Crime Commission of New York City. In 2007, a student at Virginia Tech killed 32 people before turning the gun on himself. More recently, 9 people were killed and 9 others injured during a 2015 attack at Umpqua Community College in Oregon. That same year, a shooting took place at Wayne Community College in Goldsboro. Kenneth Morgan Stancil III, armed with a 12-gauge pump shotgun, fired a single shot, killing 44-year-old Ron Lane, who ran the college's print shop. In the wake of these tragedies, some are asking what can be done to prevent violence on school campuses and what safeguards can be put into place to allow students and faculty to defend themselves. The primary sponsor of House Bill 251 is Republican Representative Kyle Hall. He said in a written statement to Public Radio East that he was contacted by a student from Appalachian State who was disappointed he was prohibited from protecting himself on campus even after completing extensive training and background check. He goes on to say he believes law-abiding citizens who go through our state's very thorough process should be allowed to protect themselves even while on our college campuses. Representative Hall declined our request for interview. Other primary bill sponsors, including Republican Representative Michelle Presnell and Republican Representative Destin Hall, didn't return our request for comment. I also reached out to 6 community colleges here in eastern North Carolina this week for comment on House Bill 251, some of which hadn't heard of the legislation. Of those that returned our calls, Craven Community College, Coastal Carolina Community College, and Wayne Community College didn't want to comment at this time. Perhaps it's a collective attempt not to draw attention to the bill. East Carolina University in Greenville provided a written statement from the Associate Vice Chancellor for Environmental Health and Campus Safety, Bill Koch. He said concealed carry permit holder training involves limited use of the weapon and little or no tactical training. If there was an incident, he says he would, quote, much prefer highly trained law enforcement officers responding to an active shooter on campus without the added confusion of distinguishing between the shooter and lawful gun owners, end quote. However, proponents of the legislation say gun holders would be able to respond to a situation quicker than law enforcement.
We're not in a big city area where they're going to be here very quickly. I think it would take them some time to get here.
That's an instructor at an Eastern North Carolina community college who spoke to us on the condition of anonymity.
And look at our campus, the way it's spread out. I mean, identifying where the shooter actually really truly is, I think it would be helpful.
Currently, it is legal for those with concealed carry permits to store a firearm locked in their vehicle's glove box when parked on a college campus, but she believes that would not be enough in an emergency situation.
We should have the opportunity to be armed and be able to provide safety for our students and for ourselves. I think it would not be a bad thing. I know, I'm sure there are a lot of fears about that, but when you're able to defend yourself, I think you have a better chance of survival than if not.
While some believe guns would make college campuses safer, others like ECU student DeAndre Johnson say the law change is not the answer.
Tempers can't control a lot of different actions that people may have in a heat of the moment type situations. So if someone were to accidentally upset somebody else, and then if they just got mad, forgot about all the rules that were supposed to be in place for them, and they decided to pull out the gun and kill me and over half the campus, then there's nothing I could do to stop that.
Supporters of HB 251 feel that mass shootings at college campuses could have a different outcome if an armed student or faculty member with a concealed carry permit were able to intervene. Craven Community College student William Dawson doubts the legislation will even pass, given the recent school shootings. Even though he doesn't have a concealed carry permit himself, he says it would make him feel a little safer knowing others do.
In a small town like New Bern, North Carolina, in like the Bible Belt, the southern area, yeah, probably. Because, you know, people here are educated with guns and they have the training.
House Bill 251 isn't the only legislation up for consideration concerning guns in public places. House Bill 69, also known as the Constitutional Carry Act, would make it lawful to carry a concealed handgun in North Carolina without a concealed handgun permit. The bill has been referred to the House Judiciary Committee. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Over the past couple of years, drones have spiked in popularity. There are about 15,000 registered so far in North Carolina. Most are for recreational use, but some unmanned aerial systems are being used for commercial and government applications to prevent and mitigate emergencies, including recovery assistance from natural disasters like Hurricane Matthew. Today on the Downeast Journal, Chris Thomas speaks with Basil Yap of the North Carolina Department of Transportation about a gathering of local and state officials last month where they discussed the role of drones in emergency response.
What have drones been used for in emergency-like situations, whether they're wildfires or search and rescue or even drownings on our beaches?
Speaking with firefighters and police departments that are using them, typically they're used with a thermal camera, maybe at a fire to find hot spots, or after a wildfire. They're used for search and rescue operations to find lost hikers or lost children. We're using them post-natural disaster like Hurricane Matthew for mapping, and you'll see that at the county level and at the state level, flooded areas to gather data about what routes are open, and then just documenting how high the floodwaters have been.
Let's expand on that a bit and how exactly they were used during Hurricane Matthew recovery.
Sure. So after Hurricane Matthew, there was a need, obviously, to start locating individuals that were stranded. And there was actually people who were using them that were not part of public safety, but were just out using their own drone, personal drone, to assist in any way they could.
And what were some of the issues that you dealt with after Hurricane Matthew?
There was a flight restriction that was put over a large portion of the state, and that was to protect helicopter pilots that were flying in and out and spotting stranded individuals. So there was a little bit of conflict that we realized there. We obviously did not want a drone to interfere with a helicopter operation.
NC Department of Transportation recently had a conference on drone use, especially in emergency situations. Was that inspired in some part by Hurricane Matthew recovery efforts?
When Hurricane Matthew happened, we postponed the exercise from the fall until earlier this year in January because we wanted to allow all the emergency management groups that were involved to kind of process their experiences and then bring them all to the table.
What were some of the topics that dominated the discussion during the conference?
We talked a little bit about private individuals using their own drones, and typically those private individuals did not understand that there was a flight restriction over that area. So one of the things we need to work on in the future is making sure we educate drone users that are recreational or hobbyist users that there are specific rules, especially after a natural disaster. And that could be anything from a hurricane to tornado to severe storm or to a wildfire.
What were some of the other issues you discussed?
Another thing we realized was groups that had drones that were using them may not be the same groups that are doing the rescue. So Swiftwater Rescue Team may not have a drone, but the local fire department may have a drone. So we wanted to make sure that we had proper communication channels between those that are operating the drone and then those on the ground so that if they were to spot a stranded a survivor on top of a roof, that they could direct the Swiftwater teams to that individual. And then we wanted also the drone operators have a way to communicate directly with aircraft in the area and understand if aircraft was transitioning in and out and possibly picking up individuals or making a medevac flight or simply searching for others. So we developed some protocols around that.
How is the North Carolina Department of Transportation going to address this issue with privately owned drones in emergency situations?
We don't want individuals that are operating a drone to be cutting their teeth out there during a natural disaster response on how to operate within this airspace. So we understand that we need to do a regular interval training throughout the year, bring in all these local groups as well as state agency groups, and have a training manual that everyone can follow and implement throughout the year. And that way, we're all better prepared for the next response.
Basil Yap of the North Carolina Department of Transportation, thank you for your time.
All right, thank you.
When I say Pinehurst, what comes to mind?
Golfing.
Golf.
Four.
Pinehurst. Golf resort.
Straight down the middle. It went straight down the middle.
Public Radio East is quickly approaching one of our major fundraisers of the year, the Spring Fund Drive. As an added incentive, new and renewing members will be automatically entered to win a golfing getaway at the legendary Cradle of American Golf, Pinehurst. This two-night package includes accommodations at your choice of resort hotels, three rounds of golf, plus breakfast each day, and a three-course dinner at your choice of dining venues each evening. No pledge is necessary to enter, and if you're already a sustaining member of Public Radio East, you're already entered to win. You can make your PRE membership pledge right now at publicradioeast.org.
Whack down the fairway.
I'm Jeff Noyes, and I live in New Bern, North Carolina. We started listening to Public Radio East when we moved here in 2013. We listened to both classical and news. My wife listens all day long to the classical music as she works. In the car, I listen almost exclusively to news. We really like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And Down East Journal, it's the radio station that we listen to exclusively and felt an obligation to support Public Radio East. I contributed while I was here volunteering, stuffing envelopes, and there was a need and a match, and so I decided to contribute. Public Radio East provides a great service to us, really important, unbiased news that we can't get anyplace else. I feel it's really important that we have this independent voice. I am Jeff Noyes, and I am Public Radio East.
Coming up next Tuesday, it's a celebration of local food and waterways. The 14th annual Taste of Coastal Carolina takes place in downtown New Bern. The event is presented by the nonprofit Sound Rivers and features restaurants and food trucks from across eastern North Carolina, providing an assortment of mouthwatering food samples ranging from savory to sweet. Today, Mac McKee speaks with Director of Development at Sound Rivers, Corinne Everett Belch, about the event.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the mission of Sound Rivers is?
Sure. Sound Rivers works to protect the health of the Neuse and the Tarpamlico River basins. We have three river keepers who work with the community to stop pollution.
Now, how long have you been involved with a Taste of Coastal Carolina, Corinne?
Well, this is actually my first year at the Taste of Coastal Carolina. I'm a recent transplant to New Bern. I started working with Sound Rivers in January, officially. And I've been working on the Taste of Coastal Carolina since the fall.
Now, people will be able to sample a wide variety of food from restaurants across eastern North Carolina. How many local chefs will be participating in the event?
Right now, we have 20 restaurants participating. And we're really excited to have a really wonderful, diverse array of local flavors out for people to sample.
Have there been promises of anything exotic or maybe unusual on the menu that people should look out for?
Well, we have 20 restaurants coming. I think there will be something interesting and exotic for everyone. I don't actually know what's going to be on the menu. Everyone from every restaurant that we're working with is preparing that right now and thinking that up. I know Tom from Christoph's the other day was telling us about a sort of a barbecue plate in a bite that he might do, which is a hush puppy with some pork barbecue inside it, as well as topped with some coleslaw. So you've got your entire barbecue plate there in one bite. But I know Tom also mentioned this is a great time for him to try out things that he might put on his menu, but hasn't yet. There is a competitive aspect to Taste of Coastal Carolina, so all our chefs are bringing their best because we have first, second, and third place, and the attendees actually vote for who will win our coveted Peppermill Trophy.
Now, how does that voting process work?
Well, everyone who attends gets 5 tokens, and they go around sampling the flavors, having fun, having a great time, and when they feel so moved, they vote by placing a token or more tokens in the jug that's on their favorite restaurant's table. At the end, we'll count up all the tokens and we'll declare who's the best of the Taste of Coastal Carolina.
On March 14th, what time does the competition begin?
Well, the event will start at 6 p.m., so that's when attendees arrive and start tasting food, and you can start voting as soon as you get there. So it'll be from 6 to 8 p.m. that we run the event and the competition.
Now, how many people are you expecting for the Taste of Coastal Carolina?
We have about 350 tickets available. We still have some tickets available, so if you're interested, I would suggest getting those before we sell out.
Now, is this your major fundraiser for the year for Sound Rivers?
It is one of our major fundraisers. We also host an oyster roast in the fall in Washington, North Carolina, which is where another of our offices is located. So we have a fall event and a spring event, and Taste of Coastal Carolina is our big spring event.
Corinne, will there be any entertainment for the event on the 14th?
Yes. Dan Phillips will be providing us musical entertainment for the evening.
What is your overall goal for the event, Corinne?
You know, we're bringing the community together to celebrate the rivers that surround our city, as well as chat with the river keepers who are going to be there, taste wonderful local food. It's a fundraiser for Sound River, so your ticket purchase goes to our mission of protecting the health and beauty of the Tarpamlico rivers. So it's a really great opportunity for the community to come together and celebrate, support our rivers, as well as our local restaurants.
And of course, Corinne, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Downeast Journal.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about Sound Rivers and Taste of Coastal Carolina.
If you need more information about a Taste of Coastal Carolina on March the 14th, you can always check out the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org.
Corporal punishment is still a legal practice in North Carolina schools, but today there are just 2 districts in the state where educators still inflict pain on students as a form of discipline. One is Downeast in Robeson County. The other is in the mountains of Graham County and Western North Carolina. WUNC's Jess Clark takes to both districts where school administrators still believe in the power of the paddle.
Robbinsville High School sits in a small gap in the Smoky Mountains. Green slopes dotted with a few cattle hug in around the school before they rise into a thick cover of pine trees. If there's one word to describe this area, it would be isolated.
So this is like really in the mountains here.
It is really in the mountains, yes.
David Matheson is principal of Robbinsville High School, and he's the only high school principal in the state that still uses corporal punishment. At Robbinsville, corporal punishment takes the form of paddling, a few licks on the behind with a long wooden paddle delivered by Matheson. Last year, he paddled 22 students. The school's policy allows students to request a paddling in place of in-school suspension, or ISS. Matheson says this practice keeps students in the classroom.
Most kids would tell you, that they choose the paddling so they don't miss class. And even though they get their work in ISS, it's still not like being in the class, in front of the teacher.
Robbinsville senior Allison Collins says she chose to be paddled her sophomore year after her phone went off in class.
That's like my first time ever being in trouble.
Collins went to the assistant principal's office where she was told she had a day of ISS. Collins told Principal Matheson she'd rather take a paddling, and Matheson called her father to get his permission.
And my dad was like, just paddle her, because down here in the mountains, we do it the old school way.
Matheson says he only paddles a student if he gets permission from the parent. And he says very few parents opt out.
And I think that's one of the reasons maybe so many parents are good with it. It's not something that I'm saying, hey, this is what I'm going to do. It's how I'm going to deal with your child. It's something that the family decides.
Matheson leads me to the band room, where Robbinsville parent Sherry Lynn is substitute teaching.
Oh, no, you found me.
Yeah. Lynn says she and many other Robbinsville families support the use of corporal punishment in school.
I think it goes back to traditional values. A lot of the parents still hold to the traditional values of corporal punishment. They use it at home, and so the school is an extension of the home.
In a small, isolated, and tight-knit community like the one in Graham County, it's not hard to see why families might have more trust in their school administrators than families in other districts. Matheson says he went to school with a lot of his students' parents. Still, not everyone at Robbinsville is on board.
Now, I've got a couple student teachers down here. They might offer a little bit different perspective. Hey guys, how are you?
In a classroom down the hall, we come on student teacher Bo Cronland. He's taking a breather between classes. Cronland says he's not comfortable with the way the school uses the paddle.
Last semester, one of my freshmen did get spanked, and that's how I knew they did corporal punishment here. So I was like, oh no, like, I'm not incredibly for it in school, depending on kind of just what the mishap is, because you got spanked for just talking in class. So I'm just kind of like, kids talk. So I don't think they should get spanked for it.
There are decades of research showing corporal punishment leads to bad outcomes for students. Higher dropout rates, increased rates of depression and substance abuse, and increased violent episodes down the road. Matheson says he's seen that research, but he still believes paddling is an effective form of discipline.
I feel like if it was still used more often in our schools, we'd have a whole lot better society. I do. I believe that.
Graham County isn't the only community that supports corporal punishment in schools. More than 300 miles east, we trade mountain forests for the flat, sandy lowlands of Robeson County. Venus Maynor is in his driveway, working on a truck he owns for his waste removal business. Maynor has a 10-year-old son who goes to school just down the road at Prospect Elementary. Last year, Prospect staff paddled 31 students. Maynard's son Ori got paddled in the second grade.
He and another little fellow were running outside of the line. And the teacher, she pulled him back in line and told him, says, hey, we're gonna paddle you for not doing what we asked you to do. And, of course, she made good on her promise. She paddled him when he got back to the room with a witness, he and the other little boy. And when his mother picked him up, the little boy that was in trouble with him says, Miss Cicely, Ori got a paddling today. Me and him got a paddling.
Maynor says he believes paddling or spanking is an important part of raising a child. He points to a tall tree along the edge of his property.
If you go to that big pine tree over there, that mature pine on the ditch there, you can't do anything but cut it down. There's no sway in that tree. You can't make that tree do anything but just either cut it down or just steady grow. And if you start early with that sapling there, if you need it to go to grow that way, you can tie a string to it and pull it, and it's going to grow the way you tie the string. And in respects to raising a child, it's the same way.
It's not unusual for parents to support the use of corporal punishment as a form of discipline. Recent surveys show about 75% of Americans believe it's sometimes necessary to spank a child. What is unusual is that these parents support corporal punishment in school. That's where Tom Vitaglione of child advocacy group NC Child takes issue with the practice.
When it gets to the schools, we now have an agent of the state hitting a child. And we don't believe that should happen, and that cultural issues should not override that perspective.
It's safe to say most parents at Prospect Elementary or Robbinsville High School don't see school staff as agents of the state. These are both unusually tight-knit communities. Graham is one of the most geographically isolated counties in the state, and Prospect Elementary is a majority Lumbee Indian school in the state's oldest and most established Lumbee community. Maynor, who is Lumbee, says he has a rare degree of trust in Prospect Elementary School staff.
Yes, I do. I trust the teachers and the principal to, you know, do what's right.
Still, even in these two communities, paddling is on the decline. In fact, last school year, both districts cut their number of paddlings in half. NC Child's Vitaglione and other child advocates would like there to be zero paddlings. They're asking state legislators to outlaw the practice in schools for good. In Prospect, I'm Jess Clark.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.